Without any further ado, I want to introduce Jimmy D from Dallas, Texas.
Hi everybody, my name is Jimmy Dean. I'm an alcoholic. I've been sober since 25th of August, 1997, and I'm very thankful for that this evening. And it is an honor and a privilege to be at your group. They told me when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, it was an honor and a privilege to do anything at all for Alcoholics Anonymous. They told me that I earned my seat in AA. I didn't really believe any of that stuff when I first came. But I watched it, and in short order, I realized that enthusiasm is palpable. There's enthusiasm in this room. Don't ever lose the enthusiasm. Don't ever lose the enthusiasm. We met a couple years ago, I guess, at Man to Man in Brownwood, and I've gone to Lakeside Conference, which is just up the road from Man to Man, since I got sober. And I'd never been to that particular conference, and I was talking to somebody before the meeting, and I'm an introverted person. I'm sure I can talk your ear off if I get you cornered over there somewhere, but by default, I am a guy who is at the corner of the room. I'm in the back. I'm on the row in the very, very back, and I'm waiting to escape. I don't know exactly what I'm going to escape from, but pretty much it's all doom and gloom, you know? And I had to be told to talk when I came to AA, and they're really sorry that they gave me that direction today. Thank you for your talk. I got sober at a group called the Big Book Group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Dallas, Texas, and the format of our Saturday night speaker meeting was 2 10-minute speakers followed by a coffee break followed by a main lead. We didn't give anybody advance notice. If you chaired the meeting, you ask them right before the meeting. And I learned in a short period of time it is easy for almost any member of AA to make an hour talk, and it is nigh on impossible to make a 10-minute talk. And you did a fantastic, in fact, you really did too good of a job. We'll talk about that when the meeting's over. I have a responsibility here. It's my turn tonight. It's my turn to tell you in a general way what I was like and what happened to me and what I'm like today, and I hope I don't spend too much time in what I was like. I'm sure we all know about drunkenness. We all know about destruction. I talked to a man that I sponsor on the way down here. His call-in's at 10 o'clock in the morning, and I didn't get him at 10, or he didn't get me at 10, and so I called him after I got on the road. We talked for a few minutes, and he said, well, how far are you? And I said, well, I'm just on the other side of Waco. And he said, well, I hope you don't have a hard time getting into Austin. I said, I've never had any trouble getting into any city. I have an awful big problem getting out of cities. Before I sobered up, I spent 4 or 5 days in Waco once. I could not get back to Dallas. It took me a day to get to West, and I saw it's only about 20 miles from Waco to West, and I don't know, the screw top wine just kept getting in the way. I am a Dallas boy. I was born in a little area of Dallas called Lakewood, and Lakewood's like a little bitty town in the middle of the big city. I'm sure there are parts of Austin that are exactly the same. We don't need a newspaper. We've got the word-of-mouth program. It works just fine. We know everything that everybody's doing. We know what they did. We know what they're doing. We know what they're planning on doing. And I grew up in a big house. It's right across from the Lakewood post office. It's kind of a Herman Munster-looking-like house. Had a lot of little bitty rooms, a lot of little places to hide. And I used to just make up games on my own, hide in corners and wait for people to come look for me. And my mother's from South Louisiana, Metairie, right across the bridge from New Orleans. She'd come to Dallas to go to SMU. She was majoring in art history at Southern Methodist University, and somehow she got in a geology class. I'm not sure why an art history major needs to take geology, but she did. And she met my father. My father was on part-time faculty at SMU. He was a geologist, geophysicist, had a bunch of advanced degrees, and he was, that was his form of service to the university. He'd come over there and teach some classes. And anyway, boy met girl on SMU campus, and they were fond of one another. And a couple years after that, she graduated from school. A year after that, they got engaged. The year after that, they got married. The year after that, they had me. I mean, within like 12 months and 3 days of everything. And my mother was obviously on some kind of schedule. When I was a little boy, we had that big old house, and my mother stayed at home, and she took care of me, and we had some hippies that lived in our garage apartment, and I think her hands were probably full between me and the hippies. And my dad traveled all the time, and he'd leave late Sunday night, early Monday morning, and I couldn't tell time. My mother would say, just a few rounds of the clock. I'd run in the kitchen, I'd say, when's Daddy coming home? She'd say, just a few rounds of the clock, and he's always coming back. And you know, he would come in the house, and it was just almost like a weekly occurrence, but he would come back in that house, and he'd stand in that foyer of his big upstairs, kind of like that landing up there, And I would stand upstairs on that landing, and I'd see him come into that foyer of that house, and I'd wait for him to bellow, because that's what he did. He slammed the door so everybody knew he was at home, and then he would bellow, "I'm home, I am home, I am home." And I would run downstairs, and I'd find out what had happened, where he'd been, what he'd been doing. He'd say, "Jimbo, reach in the pocket." I'd reach in his breast coat pocket, and I'd find an arrowhead, and he'd say, "That came from Alamogordo, New Mexico." And he'd tell me some fantastic tale about Alamogordo, New Mexico, and he'd say, "Reach in that other pocket." And I'd reach in another pocket, and I'd find a Flintstone, and he said, "I went out to Brawley, California, and I found that Flintstone on the plains of Brawley, California." Made all of that stuff sound so magic. Now, after I grew up, I've been to both those places. I've been to Alamogordo, New Mexico, and I've been to Brawley, California. No offense if you're from there, but there's nothing magic about either one of those places. You know, I don't know, I was 4, maybe 5 years old. It was cold. I remember it was cold. My mother was always busy whenever my dad was leaving because she knew, just like I knew, that just a few rounds of the clock and he was always coming back home. That particular night, she wasn't busy. She was standing in the kitchen and she was watching him leave. She was looking at that driveway and watching him load up stuff. She watched him back out of that driveway and she was crying, and I remember thinking, why in the world would she be crying? Because she knows, just like I know, that he always comes back home. And he was leaving. And I wasn't going to see or hear anything again from my real father until I was 19. I was 19 years old and I was a sophomore at SMU, and I got a telephone call one day. This young woman had found my name and telephone number in the phone book, and she called and said, "Are you the Jimmy Dean that I'm looking for?" I don't know about you, but my drinking career, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, we got drinking careers in AA. And my career had started by the time I was 19, and I'll tell you, we had to have a little investigative dialogue before I said yes, that I was the Jimmy Dean that you were looking for. Because we need to know why you're looking for me. And we talked for a few minutes, and she was the daughter of a woman that my father had married. They lived within 6 or 7 miles of me all those years, and she called me to tell me my father had a stroke and died. She had heard over those years that there had been another family, that there had been another marriage. And you say, why in the world is that guy standing behind that podium wasting all that time telling us about all that stuff that happened all those years ago? Because alcoholism is not about alcohol. Alcoholism is about the stuff that I brought with me when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can tell you that I was 32 years old when I came to you, long time after all of that stuff transpired. And at about, I don't know, 6 or 7 weeks of sobriety, I was in the car with my sponsor, and we were on our way to Mesquite. He was going to make a talk. And I was ready to drop the bomb on him, just like I've dropped the bomb on so many people over all those years. I wanted to let him know why I drank the way that I drank. I wanted to let him know how much I had suffered. I wanted to let him know about all of those things that had happened early on. You would drink too, kind of stuff. So I said, you know, my father left when I was 4 years old, and he died 15 years later. I never saw or heard anything else from him. I just got a phone call one day, and they told me that he was dead. And he said, that's when you and your father and your mother split up, when you were 4. And I said, yes. And he said, oh, you happened to be a little boy who was growing up in a house where the two parents just couldn't stay together. That simple. One sentence. I thought he was, I didn't know where he channeled that wisdom. My mother did whatever she needed to do the next year. She tried to raise me as best she could. I started school. After I started school, I heard she was going to have this date. I didn't know anything about what dates were. I really didn't know anything about what was coming to the house, but I stood out on the porch and I waited for whatever was going to show up. And it was about 1969, and all of a sudden we heard this car. We heard it long before we saw it. Well, this to drive looked awful black to a 5-year-old boy standing on that porch. All of a sudden, it was bright yellow, just glow-in-the-dark yellow. It wasn't taupe, it wasn't off-white, it was glow-in-the-dark yellow. It was a Ford Fairlane 500 convertible. And here's this guy with lamb chop sideburns and curly black hair driving this yellow convertible. He got out and slammed that door. He had his name, Jack, painted in big red letters on the side of the front door. He's as different from my daddy as daylight from dark, I guarantee you that. He came out to that house. I looked up at him. He looked down at me. I looked up at him. He looked back down at me. He got tired of the game. He picked me up, spun me around, and I loved him from the first time that I ever saw him. They went off on a date at White Rock Lake, which is a little lake. It used to be a water reservoir for Dallas at the turn of the last century, and it was pretty much just a place to go drink and learn about life. And so they were going to learn a little bit about life. And they didn't need a tow-headed 6-year-old kid in the back of that yellow convertible, I'll guarantee you that. And so they dumped me off. And they dumped me off at his mother's house, and she's the only family that I have today. I'll tell you a little bit more about her later on in my story. Anyway, what happened is my mother was a devout Catholic. She went to church every day that I could ever remember, and he gave her enough time to do what she needed to do, which in 1970 was difficult, and so she could marry in the church. And so they got married, and I'm here in Lakewood. I'm growing up with all these little kids, all these little Lakewooders of tomorrow, and all of a sudden, Dad comes home, my stepfather comes home, and says, "We're moving to Lafayette, Louisiana." I didn't think it was a very good idea. My mother was so excited she couldn't stand it because she was going back to her people, you see. She was from the deepest of the deep South. She had come to the North, to Dallas, to go to school, and she did not expect to spend her life in the North. And we bought a big house on the New Iberia Road, and we lived out in the country. Every kid's last name ended in O, E-A-U-X, Thibodeau, Mo, Flo, Arsenault. They thought Jimmy Dean was the weirdest name. The teacher would call it 6 or 7 times. "What's your name? Are you sure they haven't left any letters off that name?" It was a great year. Great time, great memories, great year. The end of that year, my mother took me to the Lafayette Airport at the beginning of the summer. My grandmother had flown down. My stepfather's mom had flown down to Lafayette. She'd bring me back to Dallas for the summer. Back then, 1973, there weren't even laws about anything. My mother got on the plane with me. She sat next to me on that plane, and she said, "We're going to go off and take these trips and see these wonderful places. I'm going to send you letters, and I'll write you postcards. You don't believe how quickly the summer's going to pass, and we're all going to be back here together in Lafayette." She kissed me on the cheek, and she left. We flew to Dallas. Next morning, early in the morning, I heard the phone ring, and I heard people laughing and talking. I smelled breakfast. I knew something was going on downstairs, and so I went down what we called the service stairs, and they ended in the kitchen. I got to the last tread of that stair, and it was a big room, but it wasn't nearly big enough for the 60 or 70 people that were packed in. Everybody got quiet. My grandmother looked at me, and she said, "We've got to go back to Lafayette. Your mother's had an accident. We got to go back just as quickly as we can." And I was 8 years old, and I remember thinking, I've been around my mom longer than anybody else in this kitchen, and I don't understand why in the world we're making a big deal out of this. Those of you who are old enough to remember know that cars were huge back then, and my mother drove the biggest of the big car. And every time we went, it seemed like anywhere at all, if you were within 500 feet of her in any parking lot, she hit you. She backed in or forwarded in or whatever in. She had a little slip of paper, and she'd write something on that slip of paper, and she'd say, "Jimbo, run that note." And I would take that note, and I'd put it underneath your windshield wiper. And she'd go, "My gosh, I can't believe I've had another accident. How in the world have I had another accident?" 8-year-old child, that's what I understand that we're talking about. We gathered some people. We gathered some clothes. We went to Lafayette. For the next 8 or 9 days, it seemed like it was always dark. Before the sun would come up in the morning, we'd go to Our Lady of Lourdes Hospital in Lafayette, Louisiana, and they dropped me in a waiting room. And it had these square tiles in the ceiling with a bunch of little pinhole dots, and I would sit there and I would look up at that ceiling and I'd count those dots in those ceiling tiles until I couldn't count any higher, and I would look down the hallway and I'd watch people go in and out of my mother's hospital room. And I remember thinking, if they'd just take me down that hallway, if they'd just let me in that room, I could hold her hand, I could whisper in her ear, I could fix it. I know I can fix it. And nobody talked. They didn't say anything at all. 8 days after all that process started, a priest came by and he grabbed me in that waiting room and gave me a prayer card and he said, "Think good thoughts about your mother." And that's whether to let me know that she had passed away. She'd been run off the road by something or somebody when she had left me at that Lafayette Airport that morning. I was 8 years old. Many years later, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. If I sat next to you the first, I don't know how many months I was in the program, and you asked me anything at all, I would have tried to tell you that I was absolutely sure that if she hadn't taken me to the airport that morning, that never would have happened. She's the most God-fearing person I'd ever known, most devout person I'd ever known. I didn't understand anything about grief. I understand today, certainly through the process of working the steps and communicating with you and certainly with my sponsor, that those people did the very best they could at the time that they were doing what they were doing. I know we came back to Dallas. We had a ranch at Glenrose, South Fort Worth. My stepfather, my dad, he loved that land. He didn't hunt, but he could just sit in a deer blind all day long and just watch stuff run. And I went back to my grandmother's and went back to Lakewood Elementary School. And I remember he'd call on the weekends and he'd ask me how school was going and if I'd hooked up with my old friends. And I remember I'd talk to him for a few minutes. I'd hang up the phone and I'd think, why isn't he here? He should be here with us because he's my father now. And this is his mom. And I'd hear my grandmother talk to her sisters, and she'd say, he just needs time. He misses her so bad. He just needs time, and that land's going to give him strength. And so that's exactly the process that we followed. And we did that for the next 11 months. And then one day that kitchen was full of people. My grandmother was crying so hard she couldn't talk. My stepfather committed suicide in the living room of that ranch house. Her only child. And this time I wasn't filled with grief. I was filled with anger. Because you didn't fix it. From the time I was 9 years old until I was 32 years old, but before I took my first drink for the thousands of drinks in between, up and through my last drink, coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, I wanted to hand you that big old bag of rocks, and I wanted you to cull through all of them, and I wanted you to line them all up just like they should have been, and I wanted you to fix it. Thank God when I came to AA and sat across the picnic table from the man that was going to be my first sponsor in the fellowship, that he told me the truth. And he said, you need to surrender to a power that's greater than yourself, and if you don't think you can find it, I want you to hit your knees anyway. I don't care if you think your prayers are going any higher than the ceiling. I want you to practice it, and practice is going to make you more comfortable with the fact that God is everything that he says that he is. And I began to learn. It was over the course of a long period of time. What I can tell you is I grew up. I'll fast forward this stuff and tell you I was a freshman in high school, and all of a sudden one day, and I don't know if somebody told me or just discovered it on my own, I was a nerd. Big, huge nerd. Just, I'm going to say it was. Now, I did not have black horn-rimmed glasses or pins of all different descriptions in my pocket. Just suffice it to say that it was bad. It was flare pants and dingo boots, and it was bad. So I have these two friends. They're identical twins. Their dad's a podiatrist. I mean, oh, just awful. Nerds don't need many friends. We hear about a senior beer bust. Refreshment nerds, senior beer bust. I don't know what they did at your high school. We went and watched them have it. We hid and watched them have the beer bust. And 30 years later, if I could find either one of them, I'm going to ask them why we went. Or if they, I mean, it was a significant event for me. They probably didn't pay any attention to it at all. I'm thinking we were going to write a report about the beer bust for Science Club or something. Now, I remember it vividly. And I can tell you who was there and what they had on and what kind of cars they drove. I can tell you when they tapped that first keg and they got happy. They got into that second keg and it really was on. Boys had been chasing girls and girls had been chasing boys and they started falling down on purpose. They set a tree on fire, the police came, and it was magic. Like anything, nothing I'd ever seen before. And at the end of the evening, I had my first conscious drink, which was two cups of hot foam from a tapped-out keg at the hill at White Rock Lake. I can mark the spot. And that drink didn't physically affect me, but I perceived everything they were doing with what they were drinking, and I realized that I wanted some of that too. And so I had resources, and they needed my resources. And so within the next 48 hours, I was provided a list by the in crowd in that high school, a list of things to do. And I can tell you that in the course of my life, I accomplished that list in a shorter period of time than I've done any other list since I've been on the earth. I wanted what they had, right? They said, you're 15 years old, so you need a fake ID that says that you're 18, because that's the drinking age in the state of Texas. Because you're 15, you need to get a hardship driver's license so you can drive. And obviously you're going to need something to drive, so you need to provide yourself with some sort of a vehicle. So I went out and I got this fake ID over on Yale Boulevard. I think you just told them your name and your birthday and they just made up something. I looked like I was about 5, but it said I was 18. I went home and threw whatever fit I needed to throw so I could go and take the driving test. I've been driving at the ranch for years. I passed the driving test and threw some more fits so I could drive off the lot that afternoon with a brand new Firebird. It had 14 miles on it when I drove it off the lot. I'm ready to go. I don't know where we're going, but I'm ready to go. 1978, the place to be was Greenville Avenue. Papagayo Disco, they said, that's where you need to go. So we headed off over to Papagayo Disco, and you would not even have believed what was going on in the Papagayo Disco. First of all, they were ancient old, 25, maybe 30 years old. Amazing they were still alive. They were bouncing into each other on purpose. Bee Gees music screaming, squawking from every corner of the room. I feel as uncomfortable and as full of fear as I've ever felt before. The waitress comes by with a tray of amaretto sours, and I grab that drink. Now, that was not my liquor of choice later on down the line, but that was not hot foam. When I drank that drink, I felt that drink. And that next one, and maybe that next one, and when it really kicked in, it did exactly what I needed for it to do. The fear began to dissipate. My perception of that whole environment began to change. By the time I had blacked out, passed out, got sick in the men's room, and they had drugged me home, when I got the reports back the next day of what had transpired, I realized during the course of the evening that I was as old as everybody in that club, or they were as young as me. I realized that Bee Gees music quit squeaking and squawking. It was A-OK. I could dance to it. I could sing to it. It was all good. And I lived for that from the time I was 15 until I was 32. I began immediately to make sacrifices. I didn't know I was sacrificing to drink the way that I wanted to drink. I thought every sophomore in high school had a bootlegger that came to make the deliveries on Friday afternoon. I was the guy who was so far ahead, obviously the nerd on the grade point scale, that nobody could even think about catching up with me. It had been that way for years. All of a sudden, they started to catch up. I'd applied to Rice Institute, Rice University in Houston. My real father had done his undergraduate work at Rice. I can guarantee you when I was 15, the beginning of 16, I never wanted anything more than I wanted to go to Rice University. One of the ways that they did it back then, and maybe they still do today, is they put you in touch with an alumni in your city, and you interviewed with the alumni. And I had already filled out all the exams and been accepted. And the alumni guy called me and scheduled an appointment for 3 months after the time that we talked. Within the course of that 3 months, I had become a daily drinker, if it was possible to be a daily drinker. And I can tell you that Rice dropped in priority. I never returned that man's telephone call. I didn't realize until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that I had made sacrifices so I could drink the way that I wanted to drink. I just barely got out of that high school. I went down the road to SMU. I went on a full academic scholarship. I kept it one whole year. I was a group of what they called President Scholars to SMU. My sponsor will tell you that I had potential that I tested really well. 25 incoming freshmen, full tuition, 4 years paid for university. 24 of the 25 went to dinner with the president of SMU. One of those guys didn't make it. I'll give you three guesses on who that might have been. Had a little tangle with some Tanqueray gin. I just couldn't get up the next day. And, drinking is fun. Drink makes tomorrow seem like it's a million years away, and I need tomorrow to be a million years away, just for whatever reason. We're all having a good time. In 5 years' time, I got a degree from that university in international business and French. I've lived and worked in Dallas, Texas all my life. I have no idea what that's about, but I have it, and they're not getting it back. I didn't make it to commencement because I was fighting my first DWI. I didn't think anything about that either. I figured you'd like to have a good time, you're probably going to get in a little bit of trouble. I went to that probation officer, and I explained my condition of life. I told her that things had been hard on me growing up. I probably told her as much as I could about what I knew about something like the inner child or whatever I needed to pull her in. When I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I heard David A. make a talk. David A. said, the only person who knows about the inner child is a pregnant woman. And that just is what it is. You know, there was a girl that I dated my whole junior and senior year in high school, and you can apply this to any of my personal relationships all the time that I drank. It was puppy love at first, and it became a lot more than that. I really fell in love with that young woman. I couldn't let her go away. You understand that? I could not let her go away. She was going to go to Baylor University because her family had been at Baylor since they had laid that cornerstone down there. And I looked her square in the eyes, and I made commitments to her. I made her break some commitments to her own family. I actually made her separate herself from her family so she could follow me over to SMU. I said, I'm going to take care of you. I will take care of you for the rest of your life. Just promise me that you won't leave me. And then I turned around within 2 weeks' time, and I started doing other things. And she had to track me down. And at the end of that first year at SMU, she caught me. And when she caught me, she said, it's time to grow up. It's time for you to start making good on some of those commitments that you made to me. It's time for you to start making some of these plans that we said we were going to make. And I looked at her like she was certifiably insane. I had tried over and over again with many, many different people. If I tell you long enough that I did not say what I said, you will begin to believe that you did not say what you know that you said. And I worked that as much as I possibly can. And she walked off, and we didn't have cell phones back then, and I went back to the dorm, and I waited a couple hours for her to call me back. apologized to me, which is exactly what I deserved. I waited a couple more hours for her to call me back. That was 1984. 25 years later, she hadn't called me back. My friends are getting married, and they said, please come to the wedding, and under no circumstances do you come to the reception. You will not come to the reception. Because when you came to the barbecue on Sunday afternoon, you're still so drunk we couldn't get you out of the house on Wednesday, that's a problem. You peed in the middle of the living room floor, and that's a problem. And you say stuff that scares our children, and that's a problem. And I don't connect the dots. The number of people who will not tolerate my behavior, what I understand is the number of people who are not willing to take care of me is rapidly diminishing. That grandmother, that stepfather's mother, she's 92 years old. She lived at home alone, independently, until she was 90. She feels the need for me to tell you that she did not raise me to be alcoholic. And so I need to tell you that she did not raise me to be an alcoholic. None of the circumstances of my early life, none of the things that I have described to you have anything at all to do with me earning a seat in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. That drink affected me differently than it did the average temperate drinker, as the book describes. We have whole chapters in the book that describe the phenomenon of alcoholism, the disease that actually impacts us in all the different senses. And what I can tell you is I feel sorry for the average temperate drinker, because my God, alcohol was just phenomenal. It was absolutely amazing. I'm not somebody who's going to stand up here and pretend to be anybody who would even be remotely interested in any sort of temperance society. If anybody can drink and be successful at drinking, my hat is off to them. I am not one of those people. So many people have looked at me and said, why do you drink so much? You're really not very good at it. But it took me a long, long time to realize that. So I make the rounds of hospital rooms, emergency rooms, just like I make the rounds of liquor stores. I'll wrap this up by telling you that I know all about abrasions, contusions, broken bones. I know every excuse in the book. I make those rounds of different emergency rooms because the ER doctor asks you pesky questions. If you go in on a Sunday morning at 11 o'clock because your heart's just not beating quite right, and I'm going to tell you that is not drug induced. It is a matter of you have a couple of half gallons of Skol vodka over the course of 4 days and your heart will get a little bit upset too. And you go in there and you're 160 beats a minute. They put you on an oxygen thing. They put that yo-yo thing on you so they can siren if you start flatlining or whatever might happen to you. And the ER doctor comes in and says, you're 0.24 at 11 o'clock on a Sunday morning. How much do you drink? And I say, don't you just have a pill? And then there's some kind of thing that tells you what questions you can ask people and what questions you can't. I don't really think that's any of your business. So they give me what I need, Lanoxin, Digitalis, whatever it happens to be. A couple of days later, they cure me, so to speak, get the rhythm back normal. They say, you need to take these pills for the next 30 days, and then you need to come back, and we need to find out what happened. I didn't do that until after I sobered up. I got a cardiologist after I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I got a cardiologist because I told my sponsor that those things had happened to me all those years ago. I haven't had to go to the emergency room in 11 years and some change. Go figure. I have had to take a sick day from the company that I have been employed by for almost 25 years in the past 11 years and some change. But I'm trying to make up for those 35 sick days I had the year before I sobered up. So the end for me is this. I got a second DWI. I had a wreck. The month before I had the wreck, I had gone to this country club my grandmother's belonged to for about 60 years. My largest client was having a Christmas party. Now, I wasn't invited to that Christmas party, but I need to do some public relations work. I need to do some public relations work for me, and I'm ready to wow them with a bunch of my new ideas. And so I started drinking about 11 o'clock in the morning. I got up there about 7 o'clock at night. I'm in rare form. I'm ready to unleash on them all of my grand ideas. Unfortunately, I'm so drunk I can't talk. It just all comes out, you know, it's just mush mouth stuff. And so they take my keys. They're concerned that I'm going to just wander off. And so I wandered off to find my keys. I fell flat on my head, which is not unusual. I've cracked open everything, everywhere. And I got the lesser of two scars. They thought I'd broken my back. You know, average people that aren't out, I mean, they get so worked up about stuff. And so they strapped me to a board, and they took me downtown Baylor Hospital, and I'm on a gurney in the hallway, and they got me strapped to the gurney because I'm starting to sober up, and they don't understand that. I'm in the hospital, and they don't even understand that. I need a drink. I do not need the IV. I don't don't need whatever you got in pill form. I need liquid. And I need it now. And so they put some stitches in my head. Now this one was a couple of months later, and this is because I can't get up to get to the emergency room. Had a collision with some iron furniture. I talked in Raleigh, North Carolina in January with a woman from out there, and she said all she ever had when she drank was a trailer house with cardboard furniture. She'd go out and get these big shipping boxes, and those were her tables and chairs and everything. And she said, which is perfect for an alcoholic because we fall into stuff. And if you fell into the table just collapsed. And I said, I wish somebody had told me that, because I had hard, big, hard furniture. And I was always running into my furniture and losing in the fight with the furniture. Anyway, I cracked my head open like this, and I lay in the pool of blood for 3 or 4 hours, and I go in there and I look at the mirror, and my eyebrow's down over my eye, and so I'm trying to pull this part of my head up and put it all together, and I think, how in the world did this happen? How in the world did this happen? And so I go back and I sit down, and I'm holding the two pieces of my head together, and I reach for the solution, and the solution is the drink. And I chug that as quick and as hard and as fast as I possibly can. And I give myself 10 or 15 minutes, and I go back into the same bathroom and look in the same mirror. But I've got an adjustment in perception provided by this thing called alcohol. And I hold the two pieces of my head together and I think, it doesn't really look that bad. And so I slap a piece of duct tape across my head. And I start trying to figure out what I'm going to tell them in the office. So I got that second DWI in January of 96. I got picked up. May of 96, I went to court. I'd done that deal before, 9 years before. I thought, they're 9 years apart. They can't make a big deal out of that 9 years apart. But they did. Second DWI, I had to serve some time in a thing they called the New Holland Jail, which are big cages. We could release as a condition of probation. Every time I got out of that cage on Sunday morning, the first thing I did was reach in the back seat of the car that I was not supposed to be driving, and I took a drink. I'm still not connecting the dots. I'm violating every condition of my probation. My probation officer asked me very difficult questions like, what group are you attending? And how are you getting to work when you're not driving because you don't have the box on your car and you don't have a license and you don't have any insurance? And it's just extraordinarily difficult, and I did that for a year. At the end of May in 1997, she sat across the desk from me, and she said, Mr. Dean, you violated multiple conditions of your probation on numerous occasions, and now I have all the records and I've got the file, and I'm going to send you to state jail for 2 years. In fact, the bailiff's in the next room. You don't even have to go home and get any of your stuff. We just arrest you right here in the office. And she said, but wait, I'm going to ask you one question. And I want you to think very well before you answer my question. Do you think you're alcoholic? And people talk about my drinking. They had talked about my drinking for many, many years, both with concern and certainly without concern. And I don't remember anybody ever using that word with me before. And for some reason, I didn't say, you'd drink too. If all those things had happened to you, you would drink too. If life was as hard as it is for me, you would drink too. I had a myriad of excuses that I'd used for many, many years, and I looked at her and I said, I don't know. I don't know. She said, that's good enough for me. And so we began this process that I negotiated, which was outpatient treatment. And what I found about outpatient treatment is it was perfect for a guy who wanted to continue to drink every day, and that's what I did. But something happened. Something happened on Memorial Day weekend of 1997. It was not my first day of continuous sobriety, but I don't ever want to forget about talking about it. I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in one of the biggest groups in the city of Dallas. In a 6 o'clock meeting, probably had 125 people in the room. At the end of the meeting, I was in this outpatient treatment facility with adolescents. I was 32 years old on probation for my second DWI. There wasn't anybody else in there that was older than 16. They might have had a bag of dope in a drawer, or they climbed a flagpole or something at a football game. I don't know what they had done, but I can tell you they were godsends to me. At the end of the meeting, they offered a desire chip. Would anybody like to try our way of life for one 24-hour period? I thought, ain't no way. I don't know what's attached to that chip, but I do not me. Mm-mm, I'm smarter than that. I do not want that chip. So I sat there. The adolescents, the others in the treatment facility said, get the chip, gotta get the chip, get the chip. I said, shut up, you hellions. Who raised you? Sit down. They said, you have to get the chip because it's part of the meeting. Now, they didn't know any different. And thank God they didn't. I got up and I accepted the coin so they would be quiet. And we closed the meeting. After we closed the meeting, 123 of the 125 attendees quickly left the room. They were doing what I call a drive-by in Alcoholics Anonymous. There was a man with 9 months of continuous sobriety, and that man's name was Drew. He approached me, and I'm going to tell you, we weren't people who normally would not mix. We never, ever would have mixed. Drew had tattoos that started at the top of his neck and they went to the tips of his fingernails. He had 25 earrings in this ear and 45 in this one. He had drywall and paint and I don't know what else all over him. And I am practically born in a coat and tie. He came up to me and shook my hand and he said, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous, and here's my telephone number. When you want to drink tonight, before you drink, use the number. And then even more importantly, he elicited a commitment from the new man. If you'll be at the same meeting tomorrow night, I'll be here. I will not suppose, I will guarantee to the people that are assembled in this room that I would not be sober, and nor would I be behind your podium, was it not for Drew. Drew gave me everything that I needed in my very first meeting. It took him 5 minutes to greet the newcomer to AA. They didn't give me a packet. They didn't give me a bunch of telephone numbers. They didn't give me a meeting directory and tell me the legend was on the inside of the front page. He gave me a phone number and he gave me a commitment. And I came back. I drank, but I came back. And so in about the middle of June, all of a sudden at this outpatient treatment facility, this name appeared on the whiteboard. Watch out. This guy was a weirdo. He's a weirdo because he volunteers, offers his experience, strength, and hope to those people that are in this outpatient treatment facility. He's available to talk to people about sponsorship. Weird, odd idea, is it not, that a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous would provide their full name and telephone number to those who might be wanting to work with someone to learn about the program of recovery? This guy's name was Greg. And so I called him and I said, I need to get out of this treatment thing I'm in. And he said, why are you calling me? And I said, well, your name was up on the whiteboard. And he said, meet me at this meeting on Thursday night. And so I met him at 6 o'clock, and the meeting started at 8. And so from 6 until 7:45, he sat across that table from me, and he explained to me how God did for him what he could not do for himself. He told me about commitment. He told me about accountability. He told me about surrender. He told me about being an atheist and or an agnostic when he entered the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he learned that the main object of the text of the book that he read on a daily basis said, its main object was to help him find a power greater than himself by which he could live. And he was more than willing, and he would be honored to take me along on that journey. And he gave me some things to do. He said, you'll call me every morning at 7 o'clock. You call me at 7 o'clock and we're going to plan your day. What time are you supposed to be at the office? I said, well, that's pretty open. We don't punch a clock over there where I work. He said, when's everybody else get in there? I said, well, about 8:30 or 8:45. He said, be there at 8 o'clock. Get there at 8 o'clock. That'll give you 30 minutes to do something for them that they won't know about before they come into the office. I said, but I hate all those people over there at that office. He said, get there at 7:45. He said, you'll begin the book at the beginning of the book. You'll read the forewords. That way you can learn about the history of the fellowship. You'll learn about the thing that Norm Alpie talks about, which is seconds and inches. You will understand that Alcoholics Anonymous did not, as Gracie A. would say, hatch out of an egg. It requires effort. It required effort in the beginning. It required sacrifice in the beginning. It requires effort today. It requires sacrifice today. It requires enthusiasm, and you will not believe the journey. It is an absolutely amazing journey. He always smiled when he told me these things, and so I began to buy the package, and I celebrated 32 days of continuous sobriety. I had called that sponsor randomly. I had pseudo taken a commitment at that home group. I had not called two other men that were members of my group on a daily basis. I was not showing up to that office on time. I had not reinitiated contact with that grandmother that had raised me. I just left some things out. And what happened for me is it wasn't a good day or it wasn't a bad day. It was just a get drunk day, and that's what I did. And on the night of the 24th of August, a half gallon of Skol vodka drove me to my knees. I was driven to my knees, as the book describes, by a disease called alcoholism, and asked God to help me, and I haven't had to take a drink from that day until this. I got up and I called that sponsor, and he said, you've got to call that probation officer and tell her that you got drunk. I said, I got a year left on that probation, and the reason that I got to that treatment center to begin with is because she's going to send me to state jail for 2 years. We're talking about my freedom. He said, you explain to her that you're going to become a committed member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and if she wants to know what you're going to do, she's welcome to have my telephone number and call me. And he hung up the phone. Now, I'm looking for better ideas, because I have always had better ideas. And through the gift of God's grace on the morning of August the 25th of 1997, I didn't have any. And I dialed the number 972-487-0171. We'll get you Dallas County Adult Probation. And I offered myself up to her, and I told her what my sponsor, I said, my sponsor told me this morning to tell you this. And she had some knowledge of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, not as a member or not anyone who was directly affected by alcoholism, but by somebody who respected the program, who was a friend of AA and is a friend of AA. Vitally important component of what we do. Because I can guarantee you she sees more active alcoholism on a daily basis as a Dallas County adult probation officer than I ever will as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I need her to respect what we do here because I know this works. And so I began that journey, and the journey's been talked about. It certainly was talked about so profoundly by the 10-minute speaker. And the journey is this. I fell in with a group of people who were getting the car people. They said, you come with us and do what we do, and you can have every single thing that we have. And they smiled when they told me to get in the car. Be out in front of your house at 7 o'clock. Where are we going? Well, that's not really important. Just be out in front of your house at 7 o'clock. And I said, well, I kind of want to know where we're going. You don't have anybody to tell. You don't talk to anybody. Be out in front of your house at 7 o'clock. Where are we going? We're going to hear somebody talk. My home group met 3 times a week. The group that I'm a member of today was founding member 6 years ago of a group called the Chicago Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Before I step down from here, I will tell you why in the world any group in Dallas, Texas would be named Chicago Group of AA. But it doesn't really fit in right now because I'm on a roll on this other deal. And what I tell you is 9 months of sobriety. 9 months of sobriety, my sponsor hollered at me across the room at a Thursday night meeting, and he said, give me $75. I said, for what? Well, maybe I didn't say it like that. I probably said, why do you need $75? And he said, I don't need $75. The Canyon Conference needs $75. I said, why in the world would, what is it? Where is it? And why is it? Aren't these meetings enough? You know? He said, we're going to the Canyon Conference. We go to the Canyon Conference every year. So I'm like, okay. It's western Oklahoma. It's about 80 miles west of Oklahoma City. It takes about 5.5 hours to get up there from Dallas. And so I had my first road trip in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I'm going to tell you, if you haven't had one, you need to get one. Lots of them. But I was not quite in the middle of the herd at 9 months of sobriety. I had begun to take the steps. I'm a slow process kind of a person. I had probably taken the third step prayer with my sponsor at about 4 or 5 months, and I felt the effect. The effect was electric. It was not a spiritual awakening for me, but I believe beyond a shadow of a doubt that he absolutely surrendered. And I give just for that little period of time that we were on our knees together and said that prayer. But by the time I got up off of my knees, within the next 5 or 10 minutes, I started to take my opinion back. And I began to do that over the course of the next, I don't know, 6 months of sobriety. I think I'm the bright white light. I've read the book. I mean, what more is there to do? So at 9 months of sobriety, I'm getting in the car with a bunch of guys going up to this canyon conference outside of Oklahoma City. And so you travel according to this thing that they call this sobriety order, and because it just makes it easy to get in the car. And so, of course, I'm the guy with 9 months of sobriety, so I'm in the back of, on the hump in the back of a Honda Accord between, and I'm 145 pounds, so I'm not taking up much space, but I can tell you there's a 400-pound guy on one side of me and an 800-pound guy, it seems like, on the other side of me, and I got, like, no room to do anything. And so it's torture from the time we are leaving the city limits of Dallas, Texas, and all of a sudden they tell me about the weekend and what the weekend involves. Now, I only stayed in the Boy Scouts long enough to get the Scout badge only. And once I got the Scout badge, I was done. I like room service. I like 4-star hotel. I like people waiting on me and thinking that I'm important. I like all of that. Methodist campground in the middle of nowhere, western Oklahoma. I don't understand what that's all about. So they talking about the accommodations and telling me that they probably ought to try to get me a top bunk, since normally the first year it's awfully hot. They did not have air conditioning then. It's the first weekend in June. And so they start describing these, and of course they're embellishing all of that because they want to torture me just as much as they possibly can. I realize that today, but I did not understand that at the time. We're going to hear these speakers. I said, what in the world do we do? People get out in that canyon and they talk. And they said, yes, they talk. They tell the most fantastic stories. You just absolutely will not believe the experience. It's going to be incredible. And then they plop in a CD. And I said, what is that? What are we listening to? Cassette, I mean, not a CD. They plop a cassette in. I said, what are we listening to? They go, we're listening to a speaker. I said, but aren't we going to hear people talk? And they said, yeah. And I said, well, so why in the world would we ruin the experience by listening to people in the car on the way up there? We listened to 5 speaker tapes in 5 hours on the way to the canyon conference, just in time to arrive to sit down and get our seats in the front of the room so we could hear the speaker for the Friday night speaker meeting. Something begins to happen. It was my first experience at 9 months of sobriety. I've had that experience almost every single time, if not every single time since then, since I've been with you. The experience happened here, maybe 50 miles south of Waco. 50 miles south of Waco, the primary purpose anniversary, sounds like less and less of a good idea. 50 miles south of Waco, it's a Tuesday night, and I've got to get up and go to work on Wednesday morning. 50 miles south of Waco, I feel like I have been sorely inconvenienced. Just telling the truth. This thing makes you tell the truth. 50 miles south of Waco. 60 miles south of Waco, I think that I get to see my friend down here at this meeting. I have absolutely no idea that I get to reacquaint myself with some people that I have known since they were brand new in sobriety. It happens every time. So I have this thing on Friday night at the Canyon Conference, a woman named Annie P., who has long since gone to the big meeting, who stands up and they say, you will not believe the talk. Annie just makes a fantastic talk. She really pours her heart out. She was terminally ill with cancer. Her doctor told her she was not to leave California. She had made a commitment to the Canyon Conference, and if she was alive, she was coming. And she talked about God as she understood God. And she talked about surrender, and she talked about faith. And she had me. And I thought, how in the world can I complain about 5.5 hours on a hump in the back of a Honda Accord when a woman flew halfway across the country against doctor's orders because she cares that much and loves so much the fellowship that saved her life? And I began to understand, and I began to learn, and I began to accept and apply the 12 steps, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life. That sponsor carried me through the rest of the steps. We read the book together. And then at about a year, 12, 13 months of sobriety, 14 months of sobriety, the magic really began to happen when the first man asked me if I was willing to sponsor him. And I was able to give him the answer that I was given, which is it's an honor and privilege to walk the journey with you. And that man didn't stay sober. Neither did maybe, I don't know, the first 8 or 10 or 12. I stayed sober. I stayed sober the whole time. I started going out and making some talks. They told me that you say yes whenever Alcoholics Anonymous asks you to do anything unless you have a prior commitment. I go to these groups and I stand around the back of the room the first 2 or 3 times. I felt uncomfortable and I felt afraid. I didn't feel like I knew anybody. I didn't feel like I fit in. I was the guy at the end of the bench. I was the guy on the last row. I went back to my sponsor and I said, I don't think I can do that anymore. And he said, don't you ever tell me that you will deny Alcoholics Anonymous the opportunity for you to be of service to AA. When you go into the next group that you go to talk at, make sure you shake everybody's hand. In fact, even better, you do really well with assignments. I want you to give me the names of 5 people that you don't know that you met in that meeting. And I would call him back and I would give him a report. He said, now the next time you go, I want you to tell me their name and I want you to tell me what they do for a living. And that means I had to do something that I had never done before, which was communicate with you and actually engage in a little bit of conversation. And a man named Tom Ivester, who's the top of my sponsorship line today, came to our group's anniversary. He had 40 years of sobriety and I had 4 months. And I picked him up at the airport. I still had the breathalyzer on my car. I had to get it after I got sober. They said, get the puffer on your car. And so I drove out to the airport and I picked up the old timer. We got in the car and he saw all the apparatus and I'm embarrassed in front of the old timer. Picking up the box, hitting the button, getting ready to blow into it. And he starts laughing. And he said, you know, we have a little party at my group when you get those things taken off. And I said, I'll tell you what. Bigfoot Group wanted to make sure that a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous picked you up. And I will guarantee you that if I am not sober, we are not going anywhere. This car will not move. 11 years and some change later, I see him relatively frequently. Our paths cross here and there. I see him at a book study in the fall every year. Every time he sees me, he says, Jimmy Dean, you're the guy with the puffer. Every single time he remembers the puffer. How's the journey been? I'm going to wrap this up. Sponsorship. Sponsorship and being in the literature and being in the material, learning about Alcoholics Anonymous, learning about the book, learning about how the words apply. I've been in a book study meeting every single week of my sobriety. I have always been in the book. And it's not by my own design. It's what that herd of people that I fell in with did and do. Every fall we go to a retreat, men that are connected to one another through sponsorship, and we go through the whole book during the course of the weekend. From Friday afternoon until Sunday midday, we study the text and we study the book. And I have watched lives and felt my own life change by that process. So, there was a man named Will. He's actually a boy when I first met him. 18 years old. Suicidal. Lost his parents when he was young. There's a woman who's been in my group, had a year of sobriety, who knew his older sister. Will was really struggling. He was down here at UT flunking out, living in some flea bag apartment somewhere, and he got back up to Dallas. And when he got back up to Dallas, I equated myself with him, or he with me, and we sat in the Denny's in a booth in the corner from about 9:30 till about 3:30 the following morning. And he told me about how bad his life had been and how much people owed him. And how much he wished that somebody would just fix it. And so I saw me in that man. And began to work with him, but he just was not at that point ready to surrender. Our lives had had many parallels, but he just wasn't done. And I did what my sponsor told me to do, which was let him get out there and do what the book describes. Alcohol is the great restorer, and that's what happened. A couple of years later, he came back in program. He called me one day, and I left the line of communication open and told him I was available anytime he wanted to talk about sobriety. And he called me and he said, I'm done. I am done. And so we began the journey, and I began taking through the steps. He had 3 months of sobriety, and his sister died of alcoholism, the only full-blood sister that he had. She died of alcoholism the way that many of us do, even though those that aren't in AA